From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the toxic aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. What are the lessons that should be learned and applied for the next coastal disaster? And the future of the Rio Grande, overuse and a permanent drought. Can the river survive? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It's been almost a year since Hurricane Harvey hit the Texas coast. Landfall was on August 25th. The heavy rains hit Houston the following day. Harvey delivered the wettest weather event in U.S. history and caused over $125 billion in damage. But this natural disaster was compounded by the man-made disaster that came hand in hand. The preventable massive release of highly toxic chemicals and other pollutants in the coastal area. Some petrochemical plants managed to minimize their pollution releases by shutting down as Harvey approached. Others did not. The result was an eruption of 1.3 million pounds of unpermitted air pollution. That's according to a report released this week by the Environmental Integrity Project. Elon Levine is the Texas director of the Environmental Integrity Project, and he says better planning, coordination, and monitoring could greatly improve the storm readiness of our pollution controls for when the next natural disaster strikes.
We found that the hurricane and the subsequent flooding was more than a historic natural disaster. It was a man-made environmental disaster as well. And we know that because we reviewed all of the available state government records of all of the unpermitted, unauthorized air pollution that facilities reported, mostly refineries and petrochemical plants. And we reviewed all of the available records, at the government agencies on the reported releases of wastewater, sewage plants and industrial discharges of wastewater. And what we found was that based on industry's own reports to the state, there were about 8.3 million pounds of unauthorized air pollution released into the air as a result of the hurricane and the subsequent flooding. And there were about 150 million gallons of wastewater reported that was released by sewage plants and industrial plants as a result of, equipment breakdowns, flooding, and so forth.
When we talk about Hurricane Harvey or any natural disaster or even other acts of, it could be terror, other things happen, it's all about a question of scale. So this was a huge, enormous, massive event, more water dumped on that area in the Houston area and the coast, Texas coast, than we've ever seen before. And the state's response was to give the petrochemical industry and wastewater folks and air polluters, just give them a pass?
In any natural disaster or emergency, when especially here in Texas and along the Gulf Coast, where we have an economy built on petrochemicals, and the region is built on a massive floodplain, so industrial facilities were hit hard, and that's not surprising. But many seemed caught off guard, and that's a problem. So when refineries and chemical plants are forced to shut down under emergency situations, and when they restart again after the weather, after the bad weather subsides, they release a lot of pollution. And what happened here is let me give you an example. After Governor Abbott declared a state of disaster for coastal Texas counties at about 4 p.m. on August 23rd. In anticipation of the approaching hurricane, industrial plants in the Corpus Christi area, where, of course, the hurricane was forecast to make landfall, those plants preemptively shut down, and they released a whole lot less pollution than the cluster of industrial plants, chemical plants, and refineries in the Houston area and in Beaumont, Port Arthur. When the heavy rains hit the North Texas coast and Houston and Beaumont, Port Arthur around 6 p.m. on August 26th, so 3 days after the state of disaster declaration by the governor, 3 days after that, plants in the Houston area began to shut down. When they did that, those were emergency shutdowns, many of them the result of power outages and flooding. And so what happened was, within 24 hours, about 23 plants reported events that were emergency events, emergency releases of air pollution. It resulted in about 1.3 million pounds of pollution being released along the Houston Ship Channel in a matter of 24 hours. Over a 48-hour period, it resulted in about just over 2 million pounds of pollution in the Houston area. Again, much of that triggered by flooding, electrical outages, equipment malfunctions, and the failure of storage tanks, those storage tanks that hold hydrocarbons, gasoline, and other dangerous chemicals. So it's those emergency shutdowns and those unplanned shutdowns and then the subsequent startups that really hit communities hard, and it's the vulnerable communities there along the Houston Ship Channel and in places like Beaumont and Port Arthur. It's those vulnerable communities that are surrounded by refineries and chemical plants that are hit hardest.
It sounds like you're saying that with better planning, better procedures in place to anticipate and deal with natural disasters that we know are coming, that a lot of these chemical releases could be avoided.
That's exactly right. With climate change, we know that flooding and hurricanes in this part of the world are becoming less predictable and more intense. And
When we talk about climate change, people immediately think we're talking about the far-off future, like multiple generations away. But these types of events are happening with regularity in the Houston area. They have an evacuation flooding event every year.
That's right, yeah. You know, in a sense, we don't have time to try to persuade those holdouts and people that are climate deniers. We have to act now. So climate change is happening. It's very real, and it's affecting us right here in Texas. So that's a fact of life, and it's not about arguing whether or not it's happening. It's about making sure that we are resilient and that we're protecting our people, especially the most vulnerable communities, when these storms hit and when, you know, floods hit. So, you know, anyone that lives in the Houston area has suffered through, you know, devastating flooding. We've seen storms and flooding become less predictable and more intense. I mean, the Houston area has flooded for forever. It's a floodplain. But because of man-made decisions, in terms of how we've developed the area, you know, filled in all our wetlands and so forth, floods are more dangerous than ever. So, and of course, with climate change, things are getting more intense and less predictable. So it's not a matter of arguing what's causing it. It's here and it's happening. And so building in resiliency and planning to protect ourselves as best we can. We're not going to be able to make these refineries and chemical plants hurricane-proof, but we can make them more hurricane and flood-resistant.
So we do the poster child for something that we've gone catastrophically wrong during Hurricane Harvey was the Arkema chemical plant northeast of Houston and Conroe. It exploded and burned for days there, pumping out toxic chemicals into neighborhoods that had to be evacuated. First responders hit the scene, and they immediately were sickened by the fumes. And we couldn't get good information about what was going on inside. So what can we learn from what happened at Arkema? Are those lessons being applied to try to avoid that in the future?
Yeah, there's a lot that we can learn from what happened at Arkema. And also, there were some other high-profile pollution releases. In Houston's Galena Park neighborhood, at the Magellan Terminal, there were a couple of tanks that failed. These tanks were storing about 11,000 barrels of gasoline, and that gasoline spilled into the standing flood water. And people in those communities smelled that gasoline. People reported headaches, nausea, but they weren't getting any information from our state environmental agency, which is the lead state agency when it comes to environmental disasters. And they weren't getting any early warning. They weren't getting any notification. So, yeah, Arkema was the poster child, but folks in Port Arthur were hit hard with dangerous air pollution from for example, Motiva's refinery released over 150,000 pounds of sulfur dioxide during its post-hurricane startup. When that refinery was starting back up, it released a lot of pollution into the neighborhood in Port Arthur.
Well, as I understand it with Arkema, is that this was a French-owned facility that had chemicals that had to be kept cool, had to be kept cold, and once the electricity failed and their backups failed, that's when things really went wrong, and that the area first responders had no idea what they were dealing with. Is there any sort of follow-up to try to figure out how can we avoid that again?
Yes. So local emergency planners need access to information. They need to know what's being stored at some of these facilities. The facilities themselves need to be strengthened and in terms of backup power. The state agency responsible for permitting and allowing all of these dangerous chemicals to be stored near neighborhoods and released into the air, the state environmental agency needs to take its role of issuing permits a lot more seriously. Some of those permits take many months for the agency to review and to issue. You know, like if Exxon were to build a new chemical plant, that permit is a bigger permit, gets more attention. But 14,000 air permit authorizations for facilities like Arkema and many others that the state environmental agency processes every year, and they do that with fewer resources than they've had before. So there's a lot that is happening at the local level to try to make sure that emergency responders have access to information and that they know what they're getting into when they go fight a chemical plant explosion. At the state level, there needs to be a lot more attention on how we're authorizing these facilities, and we need to make sure that the permits that they have are enforceable and transparent. And so that there's a lot that we can do at the state level to help make sure that these man-made disasters don't happen again.
Ilan Levine is the Texas director of the Environmental Integrity Project. They released a report this week called Preparing for the Next Storm. It details much of the toxic impact of Hurricane Harvey on the Texas coast and makes recommendations on how to better prepare for future disasters to prevent unnecessary large-scale pollution releases. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Much of the line that divides Mexico and the United States is the Rio Grande, but it also is bringing the two countries together to find solutions for the future of this endangered river. Much depends on the future healthy flow of the Rio Grande. Millions of people depend on it for drinking water and for farm irrigation, but the challenges to the Rio are stacking up, and serious enforceable management of the river is needed. The Texas Observer has launched a 9-part series that looks at the impact of global warming on the Rio Grande. The lead reporter is Navina Sadasivam.
The International Boundary Water Commission, the IBWC, is the binational agency that works to resolve issues around water that is shared between the U.S. and Mexico. So there are two sections to that agency. There's a U.S. section and there's a Mexican counterpart. And in the last 2 years, they have managed to finalize an agreement about the use of Colorado River water, especially as, you know, that river careens toward drying out and resulting in, you know, sort of major shortages for the upper and lower basins in the West. So the agreement that they've come to is to share water during times of drought. And that was completed in the last 2 years during the Trump administration. So even though the U.S., you know, at least politics in Washington, D.C., you know, there's a lot of rhetoric that's very much anti-Mexican. Around the issue of water, the IBWC has quietly been working with its Mexican counterparts to figure out how to share the Colorado River's water during times of drought. And it is the same also with the Rio Grande. They haven't finalized an agreement, but they have been working on a way to model the Rio Grande so everyone knows how much water is in the river, how much water is projected to be in the river in the coming years, so that they can work towards a more cooperative sort of agreement during times of drought. So that's in the works right now.
What is the forecast for the Rio Grande?
The Rio Grande, the state water plan, and several other reports that have been done about the river show that by 2060, there will be a 600,000 acre feet shortage on the Rio Grande, and that's without accounting for climate change. A 2013 study by the Bureau of Reclamation found that climate change alone will cause a shortage of about 60,000 acre feet. So we're talking massive shortages here. And some of the causes for that shortage extend beyond just climate change. The valley is booming. Its population is growing tremendously. And as more people move to the valley, there's an increased demand for water. And also remember that the valley has an agrarian economy. The vast majority of the water from the Rio Grande is used to grow sugarcane and citrus and cotton and a number of other crops. So the valleys, the soil there is really fertile, and it has had an agrarian economy for a really long time. So the confluence of those two things combined with climate change mean that those shortages are going to increase in the future. And so that's sort of the projection for the Rio Grande.
When you say a shortage, does that mean by the time the Rio Grande gets to Boca Chica Bay, which is the outlet to the Gulf of Mexico, that there's not going to be any water in the river? Is this going to be dry?
So remember that because the water is shared between the U.S. and Mexico, it's hard to sort of estimate how people on the other side of the border might use that water, whether they will let more water flow into the bay, into the Gulf, or whether they will be increasing their demand as well. So it's hard to say, it's sort of hard to predict the future and say that, yes, it is expected to go completely dry because there are so many different factors that influence that. But what we can say is that in terms of water usage, in terms of the people who live there and the different industries and the agricultural industry that operates there, they can expect to sort of feel the brunt of the river, of the river's flows diminishing. So they will start to feel the pinch.
And municipalities along the Rio Grande, they use the river for the drinking water. Laredo pulls water from the river. I mean, both sides,
right.
Nuevo Laredo, and you go on down the river all the way. So will there be enough for drinking?
So that's a really interesting question, because the way the water allocation system along the Rio Grande is set up now, municipalities get first dibs. So even if the river ran dangerously low, what would happen is agriculture would get cut off and municipalities would get first right to whatever water there is in the river. So knowing that, it seems really unlikely that municipalities will run out of water. The one caveat to that is that they might technically have water in the river, but some municipalities, because they're so far inland, they might not be able to move that water all the way into their treatment plants so that it actually reaches people's homes. So let me just explain that a little bit further. So the way it works in the valley is you've got the river and then you have a labyrinth of canals and pumps that move that water in from the river inland, miles and miles inland. So for instance, Raymondville in the valley is about 50, 60 miles inland, and the water travels in these open air canals for the most part. And it's sitting in these huge lakes. So imagine a scenario, in the middle of summer, it's really hot, it's really dry, the river's flows are diminishing. So the city might technically have water in the river. They have a right to it on paper, and it might actually exist in the river. But once they start pulling that water and once it starts moving through the canal system, these canals are so old and really leaky, unlined, they're open air, so it's evaporating, it's seeping, that by the time the water gets to Raymondville, there's nothing left of it. It's all gone, right? So there might be a transportation issue there. So in that sense, you might face a scenario where municipalities...
That can be fixed with investment and infrastructure, right?
This is true, yes. If you could build a pipeline directly from the river to these cities, that would pretty much solve this problem. But the challenge there is that it costs millions and millions and millions of dollars. And there are very few grants. Often, some of the cities there, like for instance, Raymondville, it's a small, poor city, population of about 10,000, and it doesn't have a big enough tax base. A lot of low-income folks live in that city. And so it's just a challenge to find the money to be able to do that.
What's the level of concern with what the future looks like for the Rio Grande?
So the folks that I talk to, especially the farmers that I talk to, seem to indicate that there are ups and downs and that they've seen worse cycles. For instance, folks remember the drought of 2011 to 2013. And so they do.
And that's when the river really did go dry in places.
Yes. Yes, in sections. And so there is a bit of complacency on their part where they do seem to feel that this happens all the time and we've managed before and we will manage again. We will manage if it happens again in the future. But I do think that one part of it that they're not considering is just the effect of climate change and how that will make the river's flow much more variable and, provide them with less certainty. So there is some concern there. I think with farmers, the biggest threat or concern they see is the urbanization of the valley. I do think they see that as a threat because a lot of farmers, it's worthwhile for them to sell their property to land developers who then build condos there. So not only is land being transferred over into municipalities, the water rights are also being transferred. And there are some interesting sort of political fights that are taking place in the valley between farmers and cities right now over those issues.
But this is a shared river, although the United States and Mexico, they use the river and view the river very differently. There's a lot of trust that's involved. There's been a lot of talk in the past about Mexico's water debt to the Rio Grande, mm-hmm. that Mexico was holding back water, that they were building dams upstream in the Sierra Madre Mountains. And mm-hmm. what's the future of that? Is that an obstacle?
Yeah. So during the 2011 to 2013 drought, again, when water was scarce, tensions were really high. And that's when you saw a lot of finger pointing, especially here in Texas. You had a lot of political leaders saying, you know, that Mexico was holding water back, that they weren't living up to their treaty obligations. Just to clarify, technically they were meeting their treaty obligations, because the treaty does say that Mexico is required to release a certain amount of water over a five-year period. So technically, they could not release any water for the first 4 years and then release all of the water that they're supposed to release in the fifth year. So there's no, it's not counted, it's not averaged by year. There's no cap on how much they have to release every year. So, you know, I do think that there are, that kind of scenario is going to play out more often in the future, because if you have a river where the flows are uncertain and variable, that makes it a lot more difficult for people to plan around, you know, which crops they want to plant, how much they want to plant, the growth of the city, all of that it just becomes much more challenging. So I do see some of those tensions flaring up again, but I also want to sort of caveat that by saying that, you know, the IBWC is an agency that is working with the Mexicans. And for instance, you know, they do see the future of the river as being much more variable, which is why I think they're trying to model the river now and try to get a better understanding of what its flows are, so that there's less ambiguity about, you know, how much water is in the river and who owes whom how much. So there are efforts underway now to prevent or at least dampen down some of those tensions that might flare up in the future.
So the Texas Observer is doing this 9-part series looking at the future of the Rio Grande and many of the challenges that it faces and efforts to keep it healthy. Why? I mean, this seems like to be a regional concern. Is this something that everyone in Texas or on both sides of the border should really be paying attention to?
Yes. I think the story should be of interest to people, not just here in Texas and in Mexico, or even just in the United States, but the world over, because transboundary rivers, transboundary aquifers are extremely common. There are hundreds of rivers and aquifers that are shared between countries, two or three different countries, right? And so I think one of the things that we can sort of learn by studying the Rio Grande is not only just how the politics around it works and how you can potentially cooperate, even if the two countries that are working, that share that river, may not necessarily be on great terms politically, but when it comes to water, there are ways to work around it, because I think both sides do recognize that they both need the river. And so not cooperating or, you know, fighting over it and coming to a stalemate is not really an option there, because there are so many communities that depend on it, and you would be putting, you know, livelihoods and lives at risk when you enter into that kind of conflict. So I do think the story's scope extends beyond just here in Texas or in Mexico. And there are shared lessons that can be learned for other folks in other countries too.
Davina Sadasivam is the environmental reporter for the Texas Observer. She's the lead reporter for their 9-part series called Shallow Waters, which is looking at the challenges to the Rio Grande. You can find the reporting at texasobserver.org. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can download us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.